Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. How many medications do you take each day? The older you are, the more likely it is that you are on multiple prescription drugs. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association traced a big increase in the proportion of people over age 65 who use five or more medications. In 2011-2012, nearly two out of five seniors, 39%, took that many meds. While just 12 years earlier, only one out of four in that age group received that many prescriptions. More medications mean more risks, potential drug interactions, and a greater chance of making a mistake, like taking the wrong drug at the wrong time, skipping a pill, or doubling up. Furthermore, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services estimates that nearly a third of Medicare beneficiaries, about 12 million individuals age 65 or older, have at least one prescription for commonly abused opioids, such as OxyContin and fentanyl. What risks do older adults face when they've been prescribed several medications? Why are doctors prescribing more medications? Dr. Nicole Brandt is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and executive director of the school's Peter Lamy Center on Drug Therapy and Aging. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila.
Why are older adults on so many medications?
Part of the reason for that, Sheila, is we're having more medications to treat chronic conditions. And as we increase the number of medical conditions that older adults are being treated for by multiple providers and prescribers, there's a greater risk for what we call polypharmacy.
Polypharmacy means?
Polypharmacy, there's lots of definitions out there for polypharmacy. The one that I like the most is using more medications than are clinically needed. But we do see many older adults on multiple blood pressure medications or on multiple diabetes medications. And as you think that we're treating more and more older adults with three or more conditions, we see even a greater risk for polypharmacy or multiple medications.
So does this stem from seeing multiple doctors who don't know what the other is doing?
Absolutely. Even though we've had great strides being taken to integrated healthcare systems and utilizing electronic health records, they don't always exchange information. Though many of our patients feel that the doctors are all talking to each other, that doesn't necessarily happen.
What are the most common medications older adults are taking?
There's a lot of medications for the heart. Because as you can imagine, high blood pressure, heart failure are common conditions as we age. Other chronic medications could be for mood disorders, such as depression. Pain management, you talked a little bit about opiates at the beginning, but analgesics, whether those are opiates or NSAIDs, over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or Tylenol being utilized for pain because of osteoarthritis being a common medical condition. And then we have numerous blood thinners or things like aspirin or anticoagulants, which are medications that, again, decrease blood clots that increase the risk for bleeding. So there's some classes of medications that are used more often in older adults that increase the risk for having adverse drug events, too.
And what are the risks of being on several medications at the same time?
You kind of mentioned that at the beginning, but the risk for drug-drug interactions, and some of them are very clinically impactful. For instance, antibiotics interacting with some medications for their blood pressure, increasing the risk of some blood level disorders with potassium could be potentially putting them in the emergency department. So that's one of the things we look at. And when we think about, Sheila, some of the common offenders that lead older adults into the emergency department, those are some of the medications you mentioned, opiates, anticoagulants, and medications that we use for diabetes are three of the classes that are most likely to be contributing to those emergency departments because of adverse drug events. Because again, another consequence in older adults is the increased risk of adverse drug events, not just drug-drug interactions, but adverse drug events.
I don't understand the difference between a drug interaction and an adverse drug event.
So a drug interaction, and there can be different types of drug interactions. There could be a drug-drug interaction where you take one drug and it potentially increases the effect or decreases the effect of the other drug. There can be a drug food interaction, which sometimes food and drugs may affect the absorption or, again, the effectiveness of those medications, or drug-disease interactions where you've got a certain drug and maybe you've got kidney disease, and by having that, it increases the risk of those drug levels going up. And if we don't account for that, you may put yourself at greater risk for adverse drug events. And adverse drug events are basically an unexpected effect of a medication. And so one of those common adverse drug events from those drug classes we talked about might be bleeding. So you're taking something like aspirin or warfarin, and you experience an adverse drug event such as bleeding. Maybe it's a minor bleed where you're bleeding from your gums or nosebleed, or a major bleed where you've got a major stomach bleed or other bleed that might be going on.
When we talk about adverse drug events,
mm-hmm.
is this because the patient, the older patient, is not using the drug as prescribed, or is this because the drugs are off on their own, multiplying or canceling each other, or doing, even though the patient is following exactly what the doctor ordered?
So it could be because of drug-drug interactions. It could be because they're not taking it as well as prescribed. So some of the studies have looked at, you know, unintentional overdose where patients have taken too much medication, or maybe not taken the medication on a regular basis, then started taking it again, and there was already other medications on board. So there's multiple reasons, and that gets into another public health issue, which is called non-adherence to medications, not taking medications prescribed in the directions being given to them by their healthcare team.
And what are some of the ways to prevent seniors from making mistakes when they're taking medications?
So first and foremost is to make sure that they're ideally using one pharmacy, so that at least there's one person who has a list of all of the medications that you're taking who will be looking for those drug-drug interactions. But we realize they may not be sharing with their healthcare team, whether it's the pharmacy or pharmacist, and the healthcare team about over-the-counter medications, because sometimes that might be a risk factor as well. So using one pharmacy, making sure that you keep an active list of all your medications and sharing that with all of your providers, setting up a routine when you're taking your medications to reduce forgetting your medications or taking too much. And that gets into reminder systems. Some patients might use pill boxes, or there are special packaging that can help remind patients to take their medications, or they may have a loved one who reminds them to take their medication. Making sure that you're asking good questions. There's always more need for education, how best to take them. That's probably one of the number one questions, Sheila, I get as a pharmacist is, how do I take this medication? Why am I taking it? So that way you overcome some of the myths and misunderstandings on how best to use their medications.
That's Dr. Nicole Brandt here on The Record on WYPR. She is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and executive director of the school's Peter Lamy Center on Drug Therapy and Aging. We're talking about the risks associated with the increasing number of medications older adults are taking. Let's zoom in on opioids and older adults' use of them. As I said, about 12 million people on Medicare age 65 or older have at least one prescription for an opioid. These prescriptions come on average with 5 refills. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that since 1999, opioid prescriptions have quadrupled and more than 180,000 people have died from prescription opioids. We've talked about the opioid death epidemic on this program. We usually think of younger users. Are older adults also at risk for addiction to opioids that have been prescribed to them?
Not just addiction, but also at a greater risk for overdose. So when we talk about that, and I would like to share actually a colleague of mine at the Lamy Center, Dr. Linda Simone-Wastilla, is working with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene here on a state level with SAMHSA on a federal level. And in 2014, which is some of the most recent statistics we have, here in the state of Maryland, 12.7% of all drug and alcohol-related emergency department visits and inpatient visits by adults 65 and older involve prescription opiates. 0.3% involved heroin. Among all prescription opiate-related hospitalizations and emergency department visits, almost 2% resulted in deaths. So it's important for us to look at, you know, we looked at national statistics there, but looking at local statistics.
And I think 12.7, so it's basically 1 out of 8
mm-hmm.
emergency room visits by an older person.
Here in the state of Maryland.
In Maryland, involved a problem with opioids.
Yeah, drug and alcohol related.
Mm-hmm. Oh, drug and alcohol.
Yeah.
Among older adults, does most opioid use start with their regular doctor or with an emergency room visit or with a specialist?
It can be all the above. What we see is emergency departments may be one place where they're getting prescriptions for opiates, and that's why it's wonderful that we have the prescription, the PDMP, the prescription drug monitoring programs here in the state to see where patients are getting access to opiates. But it could be in their primary care office, it could be specialist as well. So in patients who have developed tolerance and drug-seeking behaviors with addiction, maybe using multiple portals to get access to opiate medications. Where they start with chronic pain management, oftentimes it's with their primary care team, but it also may be in concert, Sheila, with pain specialist. But some of the things that have been concerning to me as a practitioner is when we start looking at where they're getting access to their opiates and using multiple sources. And that's where these initiatives, such as the PDMP monitoring program, have helped us to look at that.
Tell us about the PDMP monitoring program.
So the prescription drug monitoring program is here in the state of Maryland, where you can see where your patient who's coming into the pharmacy or maybe coming into other healthcare resources, emergency department, may be getting access to controlled substances such as OxyContin, oxycodone. That way you have more awareness and ammunition and discussion with your patients so you can reduce giving more medications to that patient.
You mentioned not sharing medications. I mean, with an average of five refills, it paints a picture in my mind that there are a lot of pills out there, and they may be in places like medicine cabinets or other places that are not secure and that lots of people would have access to. So the risk of diversion is pretty great.
Absolutely. And we see that. One of the greatest concerns is where not just family members or visitors, you know, going over to their grandparents' house and children are getting access, adolescents are getting access to the grandparents' pain medications. And there could be large sources, 120 tablets, for instance, of oxycodone is not uncommon if that's a month's supply. But yeah, it is a big public health concern. There's been a lot of attention to older adults. Where are you storing your medications? Who's coming into the home and making sure that they're locked up to avert diversion?
If someone wants to pare down the number of medications they're taking, what should they do?
So you want to look at function, life expectancy, prognosis, comorbidities, and really...
Comorbidities means other medical conditions.
Yeah, and to really look at that in a systematic way. So sitting down with your primary prescriber, your primary care provider, maybe your pharmacist as well, to go through all of your medications. And through that review, to understand what the patient's goals of care are and preferences. We all have different feelings about what are our goals of care, but really determining that to see, are all of these medications still needed?
Thanks for explaining this to us.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Dr. Nicole Brandt is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and executive director of the school's Peter Lammy Center on Drug Therapy and Aging. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break now, and when we come back, dealing with chronic pain, we'll hear from a pain management expert. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Based on survey data from 2012, the National Institutes of Health estimate that 25 million adults in the U.S., that's about 1 in 10, suffer daily chronic pain, and 23 million more experience severe pain. What can be done to treat chronic pain and improve the quality of life for those struggling with it? What are opioids, which are known for their risk of abuse, an appropriate element of treatment? Joining me is neurologist Beth Hogans, associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's head of the National Institutes of Health Center of Excellence for Pain Education at Johns Hopkins, and she's medical director of the Chronic Pain Program at MedStar Good Samaritan Hospital. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
Chronic pain can have such a severe impact on someone's quality of life, difficult to work, to sleep, spend time with others. What approaches do physicians take to treating chronic pain?
There are a wide variety of approaches that can be taken to treat chronic pain. We'd like to balance pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches, which is to say we like to use things that involve medications or the delivery of medications with things that don't involve medication. That could involve physical therapy, clinical psychology, exercise, yoga, diet. There's a wide range of things that can really be done to help chronic pain. It's really a condition of the whole body, not just of a particular part.
Tell me a little bit more about that. How, if I'm feeling pain in my shoulder, why is that a condition of the whole body?
Well, sometimes pain is just because there's been an injury to the area and the body's in the process of healing it. But we do talk about this phenomenon of chronic pain, which is what the study was about. It's very prevalent. And chronic pain is where the pain continues beyond the normal healing period. And there's something abnormal about the pain. And we often have to use a multimodal approach to bring several different treatments to bear. So chronic pain could last 3 months or 6 months, but it can actually last for years and years.
Is medication as effective for chronic pain as it is for acute pain, like short-term pain after surgery?
No, that's one of the really important differences between acute and chronic pain. We're really pretty good at treating acute pain, certainly in the surgical setting. Bounds of progress have been made in the last century between where we were, say, at the end of the Civil War and where we are today. We can really treat acute pain extremely effectively in the acute setting, you know, with analgesia, nerve blocks, all kinds of medications are available, and we can do that very safely. The difference with chronic pain is that the treatments that we have available to us have limited efficacy, so that not every patient will respond to every treatment, and that's why we really have to do it with an individualized therapy approach. We really have to tailor the treatment to each patient.
If medication is going to be part of treatment, how is it determined what type of medication will be most effective?
So the model that we've been using to teach about chronic pain at Johns Hopkins for the last at least 10 years involves what we call the three mechanism model, where one of the mechanisms is the normal mechanism of acute pain, where there's been an injury and there's normal pain sensing. The second type is pain that's associated with inflammation or sometimes infection. And that's where there are changes in the nervous system that make the body more sensitive to things like pressure pain. Imagine if you had a callus that burst and your shoe, your favorite pair of shoes, now hurts a lot. That's inflammatory pain, as is sunburn. Then there's neuropathic pain, which is where there's an injury to the nervous system that results in pain. The most common type of this is diabetic neuropathy, but we also see that in spinal cord injuries, multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, sometimes after stroke. There's a lot of types of neuropathic pain, and each of these requires a certain approach. Some drugs that work well for acute pain are not going to work as well for neuropathic pain, and vice versa.
So is it something a doctor knows going in, or is it trial and error?
Well, there are certain clues. First off, we always want our doctors to talk to patients and hear what the pain feels like. And that's why it's important for patients to know they need to be able to describe their pain to their doctor. So when we ask you, is it stabbing? Is it dull? Is it burning? We're trying to understand what it feels like so that we can understand what is causing the pain and where it's coming from. And ultimately, what are the best treatments that we can give?
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. Beth Hogans, Associate Professor in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and an expert in pain management. I mentioned earlier in the show, 12 million Medicare recipients have at least one prescription for an opioid. Are opioids overprescribed?
That's a very complex question. And I'm not sitting in the room each time an opioid prescription is written in the United States.
For sure.
So if you look on the surface, it does seem like we have a serious problem right now, that there are a lot of opioid pills out there, pills that have been prescribed by providers that patients don't know what to do with. I mean, I think if you ask any group of people how many of them have extra pills lying around at home that they don't know what to do with, right now, the majority of people are raising their hands, and we need a better mechanism because we don't want to flush those medications down the toilet. It's not good for the wastewater. It's not good for the bay. And So we do need a better approach to figuring out what to do when people don't need these medicines. And it's hard to know when you see a patient, is this someone who's going to have 3 days of pain, 7 days of pain, or 14 days of pain? In any case, we don't want our patients to have severe uncontrolled pain because that can actually be one of the precipitants that leads to chronic pain.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
A pain that if it were addressed might go away in a few weeks?
Absolutely.
Can become chronic?
Absolutely.
How does that happen?
That evidence has come from a number of sources, but one of the really important sources is battlefield medicine, and that evidence is being used in operating rooms all over the world right now where they've become much more aggressive about controlling pain in an operative setting with nerve blocks because there is really good evidence both from laboratory data with research animals and from battlefield conditions that severe uncontrolled pain definitely increases your risk of longer-term chronic pain.
I mean, we're told with some medications, like antibiotics, finish the course, take all the pills that you were prescribed. Is that not true of pain pills?
That's not true of pain pills. We really want people to treat the pain according to their pain experience. And if they're having uncontrolled pain, we want to hear back from patients. If their pain is resolved, you should not take more opioids than you need to control your pain.
Opioids such as morphine become less effective over time. It's almost the reverse of what you were talking about the pain locking in. Opioids become less effective. Why is that?
So opioids do lose their efficacy against pain over time, and that is a real challenge because someone can start on an opioid and find that their pain is really well controlled for a few days, possibly even a couple of weeks, and they turn around and that same person taking the same medication 2 weeks later will find that their pain is back and it's keeping them up at night, and it means that they can't walk, they can't go to get their groceries. There's very basic life needs that they can't do because of their pain. The drug hasn't changed. The patient has changed. The way the molecules handle the drug in the body has changed so that the molecule is now actively destroyed by the cells in the body, and so it doesn't work as well.
And so what do you do at that point?
Well, that's why we need to have a comprehensive pain management approach, and it's why we do want to blend opioids with other medications. I don't think we've talked yet about the NSAIDs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which carry their own side effects. You have your acetaminophen, which has its own side effects. You have your neuromodulating drugs, like your pain-active antidepressants, your pain-active anticonvulsants, your gabapentins. All of those drugs can be used with opioids and in combination to provide comprehensive pharmacological treatment, but then you also want to have your physical therapy and your rehabilitational approaches. You need to have people in the right frame of mind and on the track to conquer their pain and really get over that. Active approaches are helpful. Daily exercise and moderation is appropriate. Things like massage or acupuncture, meditation, all of those things can come into play to really help someone get successfully through a bout of chronic pain.
So is there a simple way to answer this question? What advice would you give someone who is struggling with chronic pain?
Someone who's struggling with chronic pain needs to find a partner, a healthcare provider who is a partner to them, whether it's a physician or a nurse practitioner, whatever, bona fide health provider that can help them coordinate their care. Because ultimately, what we know is that people with chronic pain do better when they deeply engage in their own return to health. We call that self-efficacy. So to the extent that someone can really embrace the problem, understand it, and work with their healthcare provider as a partner, they're going to do better.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Beth Hogans is Associate Professor of Neurology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Medical Director of the Chronic Pain Program at MedStar Good Samaritan Hospital. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.